NPR's Washington, D.C. headquarters is filled with people privileged to travel around the world to bring back stories about remarkable persons. For the past 4 years, one of the most remarkable was sitting right downstairs. Gary Smith was a big, friendly man with a joshing smile who presided over the front desk. With undiscriminating warmth, he welcomed employees and visitors, executives and tourists, delivery people, and those who'd just wander in to use a bathroom. Gary Smith died this week at the age of 57. He loved his family, his friends, his faith, his work, and the Pittsburgh Steelers. That order was reversed during the football season. Gary managed to have personal relationships, friendships, with hundreds of people at the same time and regarded his friendships as living things to be nourished every day. He remembered birthdays, hometowns, and the names of your children. He asked about spouses, mothers, and where you got those shoes. He told you what he thought about those shoes. Once I brought our daughter's deceased fish, Salmon Fishty, into work in a plastic bag. I was going to get a new fish, switch salmons, if you please, on the way home. I told Gary I had to put the late Sammy in a bin. Gary said, "You can't do that, Scott. That little fish has a soul. Everyone has a soul. We have to bury him." So we went outside together, scooped out a small hole, and consigned Salmon Fishty to eternal rest under a city tree. When I was flummoxed about what to say, Gary spoke up. "Sammy, you were a great little fish, and little girl loved you. Thank you." It was as perfect an oration about a life as I've ever heard. NPR's White House correspondent David Green is also a Steelers fan. After David's mother died, Gary would call him on Sundays because he knew David missed talking to his mother during the games. When the Steelers were welcomed to the White House after winning the Super Bowl, David made certain Gary got a credential. The two of them gawked and squealed, but Gary made sure to get David an autograph from his mother's favorite player. "Here's a man who asked for so little," David said this week, "and yet was willing to spread love to strangers who walked through those glass doors." Gary was religious in a building filled with people in a profession that's known for attracting skeptics. Yet I heard a few reporters say yesterday, if a person as good as Gary was religious, maybe there's something to God. I think that something was reflected in the way Gary reminded us, everyone has a soul. People would walk through those glass doors, hurried, harried, anxious, timorous, angry, or distressed. Gary beheld them with a kind of rare insight at which journalists can only marvel. Gary Smith saw through to people's souls, and the beauty that Gary was determined to see in others was the loveliness that lit up his face and so many lives every day.
And the goal.
Here we go.
This town of Pittsburgh's heart and soul.
Here we go.
With Kyle Bauer, we'll get the job done. This is the year we'll get.
Let's win one for Gary. This is NPR News.
It's an unusual first, a musical comedy written for and released exclusively on the internet by a very successful television writer. Hundreds of thousands of viewers watched the first two episodes of Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog online. Tomorrow, they'll get to see the third and final installment. NPR's Laura Seidel reports on this surprise hit.
Dr. Horrible has to practice his evil laugh.
Ah, ha, 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 ha. So that's, you know, coming along.
To look evil, he wears a white lab coat and black goggles on his head. Alas, his slightly frightened-looking blue eyes and pale, sun-starved skin make him look more like a baby polar bear, kind of cuddly. Maybe that's why he still hasn't been accepted to the Evil League of Evil.
But my application is strong this year. A letter of condemnation from the deputy mayor. That's got to have some weight, so fingers crossed.
Dr. Horrible was created exclusively for the web by Joss Whedon, who also created Buffy the Vampire Slayer for television. Dr. Horrible has the same kind of quirky cult hit feel, but it bypasses television altogether. And Whedon says the web gave him a new kind of creative freedom.
I'll decide, based on
what I think we can pull off and how many songs I think we can write and, you know, how much story we have to tell.
It's fun to watch the aspiring evil genius break into a heartsick love song because he just can't seem to talk to a girl he meets regularly at the laundromat.
Laundry day, see you there, under things, tumbling.
Dr. Horrible is played by actor Neil Patrick Harris of Doogie Howser and How I Met Your Mother fame. Felicia Day from Buffy the Vampire Slayer plays his love interest, and Nathan Fillion from Desperate Housewives is Dr. Horrible's nemesis, Captain Hammer.
Is she here?
It's curtains for you, Dr. Horrible. Lacey, gently wafting curtains.
All this talent got together in the midst of last year's Hollywood writers' strike specifically to produce something for the web, says Whedon.
Doing that was an effort to send a message to the community that there was another way, that we could create content and ultimately create jobs without the studios.
Whedon won't say exactly how much the production cost, but he says it's in the low six figures. He says they had no idea if Dr. Horrible was going to be a success.
We didn't really have any marketing. We couldn't afford it. Our publicity department was me and my assistant, Natalie.
When the first episode appeared for free on Hulu.com this Tuesday, so many people tried to watch it that the server crashed. Whedon says they were getting about 1,000 hits a minute. When the second episode came out yesterday, it was just as popular.
This is not just fun video. This is what we've all been waiting for.
Paul Sappho is a technology forecaster based in Silicon Valley. He says everyone's been waiting for TV to migrate to the web. He thinks Dr. Horrible is the first truly original web TV.
It's completely new. It's not a copy of what we did on TV, and it's not a copy of the things we've been doing on the web so far. It's a new kind of musical. It's a new kind of video experience. And who would have thunk that Doogie Howser can sing?
Soon I'll control everything.
Hey! Hey!
My wish is your...
Typically, web productions don't make much money. No one knows if Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog will break that tradition. On Sunday, it will no longer be possible to get it for free. Fans will have to pay $1.99 to download episodes from iTunes. Whedon is also releasing a DVD with lots of extras, including musical commentary. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
It's a brand new day. The sun is high, all the angels sing, because you're gonna die. Go ahead and laugh, yeah, I'm a funny guy. Tell everyone goodbye.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris. Barbecue is religion in Texas, and every 5 years, Texas Monthly Magazine goes on a quest to find the Holy Grail, the best barbecue in a state that reveres smoked meat. This year, the magazine dispatched 18 writers. They traveled nearly 15,000 miles and visited 341 establishments. In an unheard-of upset, a tiny cafe in central Texas beat out the longtime favorites to snatch first place. Then came the brisket-loving crowds, and as NPR's John Burnett reports, the little barbecue pit that could is strained to the breaking point.
It's about 11:15 on Friday night. We've built a fire in the firebox about an hour ago. At this time, we've got good heat on the pits that we're going to put our brisket on, get them on, and get all the lids closed and leave them alone for a couple hours.
A bandy-legged former rodeo clown and prison guard named Kerry Bexley is the owner of Snow's Barbecue. It's in the little town of Lexington, an hour's drive northeast of Austin. It only opens Saturday mornings. He and three employees arrive by 10 p.m. Friday to light the oak logs.
I want to keep my heat about 250, 275 in there on them briskets. If I ain't got that, I ain't doing no good.
Barbecue requires heat, smoke, salt and pepper, and time. The alchemist of these ingredients is known as the pitmaster. Tootsie Tominets has been cooking barbecue in Central Texas for 42 of her 73 years. She shows up at 2 a.m. like a Texas tornado.
And y'all just now putting them on the fat side down? I don't want them fat side down.
Okay. Well, you want to flip them back?
Flip them back. I want fat side up all times.
All right.
Miss Tootsie, as she's respectfully called, tends the massive iron pits and hissing fireboxes like an admiral minding her fleet. Her gray hair is cut sensibly short. A blue apron is fastened around her waist. During the week, she works as a school custodian. On Saturday mornings, her strong arms turn short ribs and chicken halves, briskets and pork steaks with a practiced flip of the fork. Standing before the pits all night, she's enveloped in smoke. But like a beekeeper resistant to stings, it doesn't seem to bother her. She's all business.
It's 3:30, and we're thinking about getting ready to wrap them in foil. They've got a golden brown.
Time was when Miss Tootsie cooked mainly for locals. But then came the magazine article.
We were named number one in Texas, and that from that point on, our whole business has changed drastically. We have gone from cooking in the vicinity of 300 pounds to cooking in excess of 1,000 pounds. And last week, we sold out before 10 o'clock.
Owner Carrie Bexley says people now routinely drive to Snow's from across the state.
There's a gentleman called in this week from Fort Worth, and he ordered a half a pound of brisket, one link of sausage, and two ribs, and is going to drive from Fort Worth for that, and that just blows my mind. $4 a gallon gas, it's just hard to imagine how far people travel for barbecue.
Within Texas, the discovery of Snow's has been met with the excitement that elsewhere might greet the unearthing of an unknown Mayan city or the finding of an unfinished Hemingway manuscript. At Texas Monthly, executive editor Paul Burka is the magazine's final authority on the smoking arts.
My first reaction when I heard about Snow's was, this is impossible. It doesn't happen. There are no unknown great barbecue places in Texas. We've been doing this for years. I've driven all around, and particularly in a town of 1,000 people. It can't happen.
The most famous barbecue places in the state are well known. The perennial pantheon is Louis Mueller's in Taylor, Kreutz's in Smitty's in Lockhart, Cooper's in Llano, and City Market in Luling. And one of them has a century-old pit. So along comes Snow's, 5 years young. But they say the brisket that Tootsie Tominette smokes is almost indescribable.
I wrote that it was as soft and sweet as cookie dough. That was how I felt about it. It was almost transcended meat.
The price of fame has been high. Snow's was unprepared for the onslaught. The question for anxious barbecue lovers here is whether Miss Tootsie can take the pressure and maintain her quality.
It was a good article. It brought us into the daylight, but it has blown our business out of proportion. There's no time for relaxation. I mean, it's constantly on my toes to catch the next bit before it starts, and here we go.
But all my exes live in Texas.
With the radio keeping them company, the employees have wrapped the briskets in foil to keep them moist. They've made liberal use of Miss Tootsie's mop sauce, made of onions, mustard, butter, vinegar, and Worcestershire sauce. The sun has been up for a half hour now.
It's going on 7. We have mopped the pork ribs again. We've mopped the chickens. Things will be moving pretty quickly now.
With only an hour till opening, the focus of activity shifts indoors to the tiny dining room. Bexley's daughter, Larissa, has driven in from Texas A&M University, and his neighbor, a beautician named Phyllis Rogers, has also come in to serve.
Yeah, we're a pretty laid-back little town, and this is pretty incredible to have these people coming from all over the state and other states just to eat brisket. Of course, Miss Tootsie does a good job. She's had lots of practice. 43 years is a lot of briskets.
By 7:30, there are already 22 people lined up outside, not at all intimidated by the prospect of barbecue for breakfast. Erin Blake and her friends have driven over from Austin.
We heard about it from a friend of ours who said it was the best barbecue in Texas, and we had to come out here and see if it's really true.
At 8 o'clock, Carrie Bexley checks to be sure they have enough potato salad, coleslaw, and white bread, and unlocks the door.
Heard him in.
Good morning.
Good morning, good morning.
Can we get a pound and a half of the brisket, a 1 pound of the steak pork,
okay,
a and a pound of the ribs and a sausage wrap.
On this morning, Snow's Barbecue will sell out in about an hour. Some frustrated out-of-towners will climb back in their cars and vow to return next week even earlier. Miss Tootsie will worry that there's not enough barbecue left for her local customers, who she's been serving for decades. So if you're curious about Snow's, do her a favor and forget you ever heard this story. John Burnett, NPR News, Austin.
1 pound of the pork steak.
One pork steak?
Yes, sir. And a pound of ribs and a sausage wrap.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. This week, Senator Barack Obama embarks on a campaign trip to Europe and the Middle East. President Bush and Iraqi Prime Minister al-Maliki talk of a general time horizon for withdrawing U.S. troops from Iraq, and U.S. diplomat attends multilateral talks with Iran. NPR senior news analyst Dan Shore joins us. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Scott. Welcome home.
Thank you very much. And let's begin with Senator Obama. The trip is going to include Jordan, Israel, London, Paris, and Berlin, not advertised for security reasons. That seems to be an open secret, of course, is the visit to Afghanistan and Baghdad. What are the politics of making a trip like this?
Well, I think it's always very touchy in the middle of an election campaign to go to a country was very much a problem of foreign policy. I think, for example, it may or may not be a coincidence that as the Democratic candidate for president is on his way to Iraq, the administration finds a new policy for Iraq. There was a meeting between Prime Minister Maliki and President Bush through a teleconference in which the U.S. said, yes, okay, we will agree to a time horizon for the withdrawal of American troops. Now, of course, you know, up until this point, the administration has said, no, we'll never give you any deadlines, any timetables, so on and so forth. We can't do that. Senator Obama, however, has said, I'll get them out in 16 months. But now the outcome of all of this is that even as Senator Obama is going to Iraq, Bush is making his peace with Iraq on the business of status of forces agreement.
Does a trip like this, which I think we can fairly say is meant to bolster Senator Obama's appearance of confidence in the field of foreign affairs, run the risk of constantly advertising the fact that he's going to a lot of places that in 3 years as a senator he hasn't visited before?
Well, that is true. I mean, he did make the short trip a few years ago to Iraq, but he now is trying to show that he really is catching up with foreign policy, where Senator McCain has a big advantage over him in having been very much involved in foreign policy. Whether it's a good idea for foreign policy for a candidate to be over there talking is another matter.
U.S. is participating in these six-party talks with Iran this weekend in Geneva. Undersecretary of State William Burns has been sent as a representative of the U.S. U.S. government emphasizes it's just a meeting, they're not negotiating. But what's the significance of this anyway?
Well, I think this is now another big change in policy quite all of a sudden. The policy of the U.S. written in stone had been, we do not talk to Iran until they suspend the enrichment of uranium. Then we will talk to them. They have not suspended enrichment of uranium, and now Secretary Burns is going into a meeting to discuss with them who knows what. One of the things that would like to come out of it is establishing a U.S. consulate in Tehran, which the U.S. has not had since the Ayatollah Khomeini's revolution and the hostage-taking. So things are very much in flux with this administration. What would seem to be ironclad policies of yesterday yield to other ideas today.
Well, let me raise a question. This is one of the things people complain about in our profession, that the administration gets pilloried when they have an ironclad policy, and then when they at least marginally change it, they get pilloried for changing it.
Not being pilloried, it's just being noted.
But there's often a critical assessment attached to it, you know.
Well, you can't help pointing out that this is different from yesterday's policy. That's not pillory, it's a fact.
In other campaign news, late Friday night, Phil Graham resigned his position as co-chairman of Senator McCain's campaign. This comes a couple of weeks after Senator Graham notably complained the United States had become a nation of whiners, and he said the country was facing a mental recession instead of real economic problems.
Yeah, well, it was in the cards that he would have to go, because to tell Americans that they're a nation of whiners is not a great way to get votes. But it was not only the nation of whiners things, but its general tendency to laugh off what others call a recession. Americans think they have a severe economic problem, and he talked as though it was all made up.
I want to draw you out about a political question this week that's dominated a lot of attention, and that's the cover of the New Yorker magazine.
Yes.
You saw it?
Yes, indeed.
And what's your impression?
Well, I saw it, my wife saw it, we looked at it, we thought, oh, that's quite a parody on conservative, whether a conservative view Obama, his wife, and all the rest of it. And we thought, well, it was a little, all right, satire, if you will. And then we began hearing the thing was on cable television all over, and all of a sudden there were people up in arms over it.
Well, Senator Obama was up in arms.
And Senator Obama was up in arms over it. I guess there is some tension in the air, a political tension in the air, in which you're always looking for gotchas when candidates say something a little bit different from yesterday and all the rest of it. And I guess what it shows is that we are in a state where you can't afford to use satire because people will take you literally and get mad.
Thanks very much, Dan Shore.
Sure.
One of the country's most successful conservation programs may be scaled back drastically. Since the 1980s, the Conservation Reserve Program has protected 40 million acres of wildlands found on private farms. Environmentalists love this program. But the Bush administration may once again let farmers grow crops on protected lands. NPR's John Nielsen explains.
In recent years, the price of crops like corn has shot through the roof, prompting cries to plant more of it. Jesse Sepcik is a spokesman for the American Meat Institute, whose members use corn to feed their livestock. He says many farmers want to start planting crops like corn in the land set aside under the Conservation Reserve Program.
Corn prices are about triple what they were just a year and a half ago, and we think that there should be an opportunity for farmers to opt out of the contract and respond to those market signals.
For more than 30 years now, these contracts have been paying farmers to protect swamps, shaded streams, and other environmentally significant lands that the farmers own. 450,000 farmers now participate in the program. Sepcik says that doesn't leave a lot of land available for new corn crops. That's why the Department of Agriculture may soon start putting these reserves back under the plow, and that scares conservationists like Neil Shader of Ducks Unlimited. He says it's far more important to maintain these reserves than it is to find places for more corn.
The Conservation Reserve Program is the most successful private lands conservation program in U.S. history. This is the holy grail of conservation.
Shader says the benefits of this protection program are impressive. Every year, for example, conservation reserves help stop more than 400 million tons worth of soil erosion. Shader says they've also put huge numbers of birds into western and midwestern skies.
Land in the prairie pothole region of North and South Dakota, Minnesota, Montana, and Iowa usually produces about 2.2 million ducks that are added to each year's fall migration. That's equal to the number of ducks harvested from Maine to Florida all along the Atlantic coast.
But it's not just farmers and food producers who need this corn. It's also ethanol producers who snap up more than a quarter of the corn crop every year. Agriculture Secretary Ed Schaefer tried to answer some of those concerns last May when he opened two-thirds of the nation's conservation reserves to limited haymaking and grazing. That plan has been put on hold by a U.S. District Court judge, but Marcy Hilt, a press officer with the Agriculture Department, says Schaefer's now considering a far more sweeping proposal. It would allow farmers to turn reserves back into fields and pastures and keep the money that they got paid to protect them in the first place. Economist Tom Elam of Farm Econ LLC says that's an offer that a lot of farmers won't be able to refuse, mostly because they can make a lot of money planting high-priced corn.
The value of the potential production off of that land is doubled or tripled. So the economic pressures on the farmers are to try to get the land out of the program so they can start to farm it.
Environmental groups say that's a change that could do all kinds of environmental damage without putting a dent into the price of corn. Duane Havorka of the National Wildlife Federation has been talking to the USDA, reminding them that the land in these reserves will not produce big yields.
It's not the level, black, deep soils that you have in some locations. It's environmentally sensitive, but it's also economically marginal because it's really not the best land for producing crops in a lot of cases.
Schaefer's office says a decision could come any day now. John Nielsen, NPR News, Washington.
All the tough economic news about foreclosures and collapses have inspired a lot of Americans to finally read the fine print at the bottom of their banking statements to find out what they've been promised or what they have to watch out for. Gail Marks-Jarvis writes a personal finance blog for the Chicago Tribune. She's been fielding an awful lot of basic banking questions this week. Ms. Marks-Jarvis joins us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. Thanks very much for being with us, Gail.
It's great to be here.
We've seen images this week of IndyMac customers waiting in lines to withdraw funds under police supervision. Inevitably, those images stir up the kind of sepia-toned photographs we've all seen of the Depression. Are banks the safest place for your money right now?
Banks are still a safe place for your money. As long as you pay attention to following the rules so that you have the insurance that the FDIC provides, even if the bank goes under, your money is just fine.
Well, up to a certain limit, though, right?
That's correct. So if you're an individual, your money is protected up to $100,000.
Is that $100,000 per family, per person? What is it?
It's $100,000 per individual. Now, if there's a couple and they have a joint account, then they're covered to $200,000. Or say, for example, you're an individual and you have your child on the account with you. Again, you're covered to $200,000. And if you had a IRA, that would be covered to $250,000.
What does someone like Donald Trump do? Keep $100,000 in 50,000 banks?
Well, that's what you can do. You can have multiple banks. But frankly, most of us shouldn't have hundreds of thousands sitting around in a bank, because when I'm talking about the insurance, I'm talking about savings accounts, checking accounts, CDs. Mm-hmm. And most of us need more diversified investments than that. Incidentally, if you have money in a bank and it's in mutual funds, those are not insured.
Ooh, that's important for people to hear.
That's right. In a bank, it's the traditional banking services that are insured, the checking account, the savings account, the CDs.
What about if you have your money in a foreign bank?
A number of countries throughout the world, and you can actually get the list on the FDIC site. Many of those countries have very similar rules to the FDIC. So again, it may not be $100,000 protected by insurance. You should double check. But the chances are that if you're in a developed country, your money is probably protected.
Some banks are riskier than others, though, aren't they?
Yes. Right now, a number of banks are under pressure because they're so exposed to mortgages. And one way you can tell is if a bank is offering a higher interest rate on CDs or savings accounts than the bank down the road. Mm-hmm. The reason they do that, and IndyMac Bank was one of those banks, they were doing it because they desperately needed deposits because they were having some financial trouble.
Can the FDIC afford to handle more bank failures? It's got a limit at some point, doesn't it?
That's one of the questions I'm being asked most often. The FDIC so far says that they're very capable of handling what they think is on the horizon right now. They have a list of 90 banks that they are watching because they think there's some level of insecurity there. They do not make that list public. And the reason, when you think about it, it makes sense. If they did make it public, we'd all get nervous and we'd go down and we'd pull our money out and there'd be a run on the bank, and that would actually cause failures. But the FDIC has about $53 billion that can go to covering these factors. And let's just say it got really bad. The government steps in and backs it up. They can sell bonds, or in the worst case scenario, they could raise taxes to cover it.
Gail Marks-Jarvis writes the blog On Money for the Chicago Tribune. Gail, thanks so much.
Thank you.